Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to take a moment to honor the memory of our first guest, Dr. Paul Farmer, who unexpectedly and tragically passed last month. He was one of the most admirable and loving human beings who touched so many and really touched humanity in ways few have. As we talk fondly about Paul in this interview, I want the audience to know that it was taped before his tragic passing last month, and we will do all we can to keep his work alive. So with that, I hope you enjoy this interview with Dr. Gary Gottlieb.
Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Dr. Sharif Akili, resident physician at Stanford Hospital and investor at Polaris Partners. Join Sharif in exploring the extraclinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Today's guest is geriatric psychiatrist and the former CEO of the Partners Healthcare System and current executive partner at Flare Capital, Dr. Gary Gottlieb. We have a very special treat on the podcast today. I could probably spend half an hour going through his accomplishments, but just to scratch the surface, today's guest is a psychiatrist, the former president and CEO of Partners Healthcare, the parent company of Brigham and Women's Hospital and Mass General Hospitals. He's the former CEO of Partners in Health, an NGO co-founded by one of our other podcast guests, Dr. Paul Farmer. And he is currently an executive partner at Flare Capital Partners. Dr. Gary Gottlieb, I really appreciate you taking the time today. It's such a privilege to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Sharif. And I'm thrilled that you do this podcast. This podcast is really focusing on the next generation of leaders in healthcare. And that's where my greatest hope is. You know, I've spent my career being in the young people business, and that is to be able to nurture the talent of exceptional young people who were, had far more vision, more energy, and smarter than I could ever be. It's a privilege to work with you and to be able to catch the ears of people of your generation who are trying to do great good.
Holy smokes. I'm so humbled. That is, our audience is so privileged to be able to hear your background and journey, because
sure.
We look up to it. And I mean, I look up to it, and just being able to you know, pick your brain on these things, it's so appreciated. And in fact, maybe it might be helpful for our guests, our audience to hear a little bit about your career path.
Sure.
It's been very remarkable, and there's so much there, but however you feel comfortable sharing it. I know you started off as practicing as a geriatric psychiatrist. You built the geriatric psych program at Penn. You went on to then become a national healthcare leader, running one of the largest and arguably most prominent health systems in the country. How would you describe your journey?
I would say my journey started in psychiatry. I started as a resident in psychiatry at Bellevue, which I selected that residency, frankly, because I had a great interest in taking care of the sickest and neediest populations. And if I wanted to learn how to care for people with serious mental illness, I thought, you know, being the psychiatrist for Lower Manhattan, that once a week on call would seem to be a way to get started and to be supervised by exceptional people who had that experience and to learn from those patients. As I think I mentioned to you previously, it was probably the most important and seminal experience of my life, because I met my wife there as a PGY-1. She's been one of my most important mentors. She runs public and community psychiatry at the Mass General, where she takes
That's
care
right.
of high risk and homeless populations. It was during the residency. Since I started my residency in 1979, I would say there were a couple of major things that happened during that four-year period. One, we were in a very difficult financial time, one that felt a little bit similar right now, called stagflation, where we were sitting with inflation rates that were considerably higher than they are right now. Interest rates were climbing up into the teens in order to try to tame that inflation over a period of time while there was a recession that was growing. that caused the election of President Reagan. And one of the first things he did was really focus on what he thought was an ailing healthcare system, because its costs were somehow crowding out other costs. That the notion that our cars couldn't compete with Toyotas because $700 from every car in Detroit was being spent on healthcare insurance, and that hospital costs were most difficult. And that's when he passed TEFRA, which gave us DRGs. And it was a really first, most important general policy healthcare cost cut effort. And one of my, and I became really worried about what would happen to my patients, people who live in the dust with brain disease. Would they have a voice? Would somebody be able to have the vision to hold their hands or to think about policy in that regard? And one of my supervisors said, you know, if this is something that's interesting to you, I think you should become a Robert Wood Johnson clinical scholar. And at that time, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation had a fellowship that focused on nurturing physicians who had areas of interest outside of general medicine. And the program at Penn was deeply affiliated with Wharton and the Leonard Davis Institute for Health Economics. And so I was fortunate enough to be selected to be a clinical scholar at Penn, got an MBA at Wharton. And while I was doing my fellowship, I also started to get outside training in geriatric psychiatry. I was interested in
such a cool mix.
So I was interested in the explosion of the geriatric population, in the interface between medicine and psychiatry and neurology and degenerative brain disease. I started to work both with some external supervision from folks elsewhere, because there was no specialty area in geriatric psychiatry, and then found a group of exceptional other clinicians, a couple of internists, a social worker and a nurse who were starting the first geriatric evaluation program at Penn. And I became the psychiatrist in that program as a fellow. So I saw all of their patients. Every single patient that was there was evaluated by one of the internists, by the social worker, by the clinical nurse specialist, and by me. And that really kind of helped me to both becoming that, I would say about half the patients who came were people who were having difficulty with cognition. Started to, at that time, there was more and more data from the work that was done by Terry and Katzman around brain pathology and these acetylcholine deficits in the brain, that this was in fact pathology, that senility wasn't a normative state. Lots of people came for evaluation of cognitive impairment, which helped me then start to set up some of the first clinical programs in Alzheimer's disease and in dementia, working together with some brilliant neuropathologists as well as those internists. So I was in that integrated clinic in which psychiatric care was part of primary care, and also started to work on doing research in brain function and behavior in normal aging and Alzheimer's disease with imaging and neuropsychological evaluation. But when I finished the fellowship, I was awarded a K Award from the NIMH, a geriatric mental health academic award, which was focused on that and actually studying the use of cognitive therapy and pharmacotherapy in geriatric depression. Everybody who talks to you about changes in evidence-based therapy and manual-based therapy, we'll talk to you about CBT. I actually was supervised in learning cognitive therapy by Aaron Beck, who founded cognitive therapy, recently passed away, over 100 years old. He was a very good friend. So I was doing that at Penn, and a new chair was just recruited. And when I was at Wharton, we did a consultation project for him around a new inpatient service. So he recruited me out of the fellowship to be an assistant professor and to set up the first program in geriatric psychiatry at Penn. And that really is what got my career started. But he was very much enabling and empowering to me. And because I became increasingly interested in administrative and management stuff, because as time went on, I got to see that there were people who were probably going to be much better scientists than I was going to be, extraordinary thinkers, and that it became, to me, compelling to figure out how to make their work easier to do, how to make the great teachers easier to be able to work in that environment, and the great clinicians as well. And I also saw the reimbursement issues in psychiatry that were really deadly and causing significant pressure on the department to be able to invest in science, to be able to invest in education, to create new programs. So he rapidly made me the associate chairman of the department and the executive vice chair when I was about 32 or 33. Really worked by his side. And several times during that time period, he went on sabbatical. So I was the interim chair of the department. We built geriatric psychiatry, created a fellowship program, built clinical programs. I recruited some researchers and started to build the base that was substantial in geriatric psychiatry while getting involved nationally with the American Association of Geriatric Psychiatry. And Penn was starting to have some financial difficulties changing with some of the payment issues that were going on. This was in the late 80s, early 90s, and they recruited a new EVP and dean for the health system, a guy named Bill Kelly, who had been the chair of medicine at the University of Michigan, who was a spectacular person. And he started to do a strategic plan for the health system overall and to have a vision of an integrated system, and asked me to co-chair one of the major task forces focused on managed care for the health system to start to build really a pathway as to how we were going to move together with this administrative leadership away from fee-for-service medicine into risk-based medicine. Remember, it's also the beginning of the Clinton administration, the vision that Mrs. Clinton was becoming involved with, and lots of people who I worked with who were getting involved at the national level. I was privileged to work with Tipper Gore and Bernie Ahrens as they were working on the mental health policy pieces of Clinton reform. And so Bill Kelly asked me, in addition to at that time, while I was executive vice chair and interim chair of psychiatry, to become the associate dean for managed care of the health system. And so I had a health system relationship as well as one in the department. But I was increasingly frustrated that psychiatry was really at the end of the scale. And it was a time in which the large payers and the local payers started to carve out their behavioral health services. And they were increasingly focused on what they believed psychiatric benefits to be moral hazards, in that one would often see that the mean length of stay was whatever the benefit was. And so if there was 30 days of annual benefit, the mean length of stay was somewhere near 30 days, and that there was really no governance of the science of what we were doing in our care and the outcomes in terms of utilization. And they rapidly basically first created a number of UR companies to do prior auth. And those companies like Magellan, Value Options, and others evolved into taking subcapitated risk and became carve-out companies with their own networks. And overall commercial premium went from about 7.5% or 8% down to 2.5% or 3%. And part of the many of the foundational building blocks that you see of tremendous labor shortages, of inadequate inpatient services, of the closing down of inpatient beds, of poor staffing and outcomes associated with that, have their roots in obviously moving substantial amounts of funds away from psychiatric care. And the benefits under Medicare were terribly poor at that time. Actually, Senator Kennedy helped to improve those as well, largely because Medicare was written at the same time as both Medicaid was created and the Community Mental Health Acts were created. And the fear was that states would shift dollars that were being paid for by people in state hospitals to Medicare or to Medicaid, where there was substantial federal funds participation. And so the rules were pretty rigid in both of them as to who could receive care and what venues could receive reimbursement or what the ceilings were for inpatient a number of days or for outpatient benefits overall, all of which were so restrictive, they prevented the development of those systems. And I was even working within the system at Penn, it was clear that the voice of psychiatry, as important as it was on the research side and on the teaching side, was diminished on the clinical side and particularly on the payment side. Even though I had this influence sitting as the associate dean and sitting in management administration. And one day while I was sitting in the midst of that frustration, I got a call from a headhunter who said to me that they had been searching for a CEO of Friends Hospital, which was the oldest freestanding psychiatric hospital founded by Quakers in 1813 to provide moral treatment to those deprived of their reason. And they had a CEO search, and they had landed a candidate, a guy who had been the chairman of psychiatry at Hopkins, and he had reneged the night before. He said, would you be interested? And I said, well, I was sitting at a particularly frustrated moment. And the question was, could I shape something in which I could more effectively have direct effect on a strategy that was consistent with obviously a board and a mission that was precious, the notion of providing moral treatment in many ways, the same way that the academic mission was precious, but also that was driven by a single specialty. So to figure out the survival of psychiatry in this context was pretty compelling to me. So, and also it wasn't that hard a move because It was still in Philadelphia. It was 15 right. minutes driving in a different direction. My wife didn't have to change jobs. It was no hassle for my kids. And so it seemed like, you know, pretty compelling. And so I stayed as a clinic professor at Penn. Peter made me one of the vice chairs of the department. After I went over to France, I created a formal affiliation with Penn because they were in the process of acquiring practices and taking risk and wanted to take risk on a couple million lives. And so I wanted to work with them to develop a way of carving in the risk to provide psychiatric care to the people who were capitated to their primaries and where they didn't have adequate access. I knew what the depth and the breadth of the department was, which was overwhelmingly in FTEs on research. And didn't have enough FTEs to provide enough capacity to provide that kind of clinical care. And we created a joint venture company called Penn Friends, which had the missions of these two great organizations, of which I was also CEO. And we did some research in terms of that integrated care. There was some suicide prevention research that was funded by the NIH. And additionally, we took carve in risk with Penn. And then U.S. Healthcare, which before it became part of Aetna, gave us about 350,000 for behavioral health lives. But to give you a sense of how little the payment was, for all in behavioral health risk, non-substance abuse, it was $3.50 a member month. Inpatient, outpatient, partial. And the substance use risk was about 75 or 80 cents a member month. And to give you a comparison, the expenditure from the pharma benefit on SSRIs was about $8 a member month at the time because Prozac and Sertraline and other drugs were relatively new. So we kind of had to figure out how to provide something that was consistent with these moral and highly principled mission and at the same time to provide care that was effective, accessible, and efficient to that population. I recruited some really wonderful people who helped build that. So I was kind of working on that. And a couple of folks I had worked with before were working at Partners. So Partners was formed in 1994 by the merger of the Brigham and Mass General. And over the course of its first 4 years, it was dealing with a major problem. One is that this downward pressure on psychiatric access and care. McLean was, you know, the embodiment of a place that had had very long lengths of stay and a large capacity in that regard, as well as a research and teaching mission. Because of that downward pressure, and frankly, because Partners didn't have any contracts with any of the carve-out entities, McLean had gone from over 300 beds down to, at that time, about 125, 130 beds. And you know, these institutions were worried, how could we close this venerable institution on our watch? What were we going to do about these financial issues? They had actually worked on a land deal with the town of Belmont that some of the land could be sold for other purposes, and there's some apartments in those places so that they could use that and put it onto McLean's balance sheet for other purposes. But they created a committee of the board of partners that was chaired by the person who became the chair of the MGH board to focus on trying to find a solution to the challenges that existed at McLean, to the fact that psychiatric beds were being closed everywhere, to the fact that the doctors at the Mass General, who so prized psychiatry, remember the consult service there was legendary and medical psychiatry was part of the mission. They were banging their shoes on the table and said, we want our psychiatry. And they were told by carve-out companies that they would have to refer their outpatients to people who were in other facilities because their own doctors were out of network. And the docs at the Brigham felt the same way. Probably not precisely the same voice because of the heritage not being identical. And Sam Thier, who was the CEO, was deeply afraid that behavioral neuroscience, which was such a critical component of the academic and science infrastructure, would be somehow imperiled by this. And Beth Israel, one of the sister hospitals, outside of Partners, had closed down two-thirds of its psychiatric beds, and others in the community had as well. So they actually did a search committee to create somebody who was to become the chair of psychiatry across Partners and a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And they recruited me to do that in 1998, which was an opportunity, I think, that presented itself because I kind of had background in both places. You know, I've been at Penn, which was deeply similar in terms of medical psychiatry and part of an overall academic medical center. And I'd also run a freestanding psychiatric hospital, a hospital that had for 200 years been a sister of McLean's and part of some of the same organizational structure. And so kind of I understood the challenges, and also they were working on a strategy that was around how having to take risk and to move partners into what was a managed care environment at that time. And mm-hmm. so I was recruited in 1998, moved my family at that time to Boston, which was an interesting and challenging thing for all of us, but I think an exciting adventure at the end of the day. I started to work together with the extraordinary people in the departments at the Brigham, at the General, at McLean, and then in the community hospitals, which had their own challenges in terms of their psychiatric services and the communities they were serving, both in terms of the quality of care that they could provide, the payment structure, the distorted incentives, and the way that their services were perceived in their relationships with the Office of Mental Health in the state, which had a pretty important footprint in terms of that care. And a couple of years into that, while that was starting to go well, and at least in a positive direction in terms of integrating some of those elements and people working on the same page, and we'd increased the number of beds, actually then decreasing them. McLean was working more robustly. We had contracts with all the payers. We were starting to work on a number of cross-science projects. Residency integration between the Mass General and McLean had mm-hmm. a little bit of momentum. It was challenging because they both had different cultures and different, mm-hmm. And different curricula, and they loved their children so much that everyone wanted to protect them and protect their own interests as those pieces were put together. And we made the Brigham didn't even have a department of psychiatry. It was a division in the Department of Medicine at the time. We made it a full-fledged department, and things were going okay. I had been working with the folks up at one of the community hospitals, North Shore, and they had some major governance problems. And the CEO had a stroke. I'd helped them build a couple of projects working with him. He had a stroke, and the board was kind of divided, even though it was a subsidiary board of partners, because of the two different hospitals that made it up, as to who should be the acting CEO. In the wake of that, there was one person who had come from one of the hospitals, one that come from the larger of the two hospitals. And Sam said to me, these guys can't get along with each other. He said, why don't you go up there? Like you did with the psychiatrist, you get them to talk to each other. They'll be nice to each other.
Gary to the rescue.
He said, you'll go up for a little while and you can be the president of North Shore while you're doing partner psychiatry. So this was very difficult for me because I have a terrible sense of direction. I barely knew Boston at this point altogether. Plus, and these places are a little bit distant from each other. Plus, they have those crazy rotaries you have to go around in circles. And so I needed to basically drive from place to place doing two different jobs. I'd spend half my time up at North Shore, then spend 2 days a week at the Mass General in one office, and 2 days with McLean, and then the break. It was like, I basically worked with the board, kind of restructured the board and the management team, and recruited a new CEO up at North Shore. And we had a new CEO about a year later. This was right after 9/11. And because we were interviewing him, he was like the only one in every plane he was flying in, because everyone was afraid to fly at the time. And we recruited a terrific person. And at that time, the person who was the president of the Brigham had stepped down, and they had just started a search. The search asked me to be the president of the Brigham. And that was in 2002. So I had the privilege of becoming the president of this extraordinary hospital, working with just remarkable people, who were exceptionally committed clinically, extraordinary teachers, and some of the most robust science in the world. Part of what drew me to partners to start with is that there were these exceptional people of another generation who were building the system. So the person who was the head of the search committee that brought me in partner psychiatry was Eugene Braunwald, who is probably the most important living internist right now. He's the father of the Timmy trials. He was the editor of Harrison's Forever. He wrote the Heart book. He's taught us more about oxygenation of cardiac tissue than anyone on the planet. So, and he's been a mentor to me since I came to the system. He was also on the search committee for the president of the Brigham and later for the president of partners. So I stayed as president of the Brigham. And one critical piece is that during that time, almost immediately, I met Paul Farmer, who I'd met a little bit beforehand, right. But Paul was running a division, was was working with Victor Zhao, who's now the head of the National Academy of Medicine. Victor was the chairman of medicine at the Brigham at the time, and Victor and Paul were working on developing a division of global health equity at the Brigham. So I worked with them. We recruited Jim Kim back, who's one of the founders of Partners in Health. We recruited him back from the World Health Organization, where he was doing the 3x5 HIV program, which is before PEPFAR. And I became involved with them in helping to build the division and the fellowship that program that they had worked on. And a few years into that, they asked me to join the board of Partners in Health in about 2004, 2005, while I was president of Brigham, and became more and more engaged.
Great crew to be around.
Yeah, I went to Rwanda with my family in 2007, where we had just started in 2005 or 2006. In 2009, when Jim Mangan announced that he was going to step down, Partners board had a search committee, and they asked me to become the CEO of Partners. So I started on January 1st of 2010, and 12 days after that was the earthquake in Haiti. So Partners in Health, which I was on the board of, had 5,000 people on the ground in Haiti. The Brigham had numerous faculty members on the ground because of the close relationship that existed, as well as fellows. The MGH was involved with the DMAT IMSERT teams for emergency response and the comfort ship. And so I put together a lot of folks working together around that effort. My wife and I were down in Haiti 10 days after the earthquake. And I just fell more and more in love with working with Partners in Health, became part of its executive committee. And as I was working with Partners on really a strategic plan that focused on a lot of the work that they're still doing now around population health, around integrating, putting in a single enterprise software system, which they didn't have at the time, building a biobank and a phenotypic data repository to put together both phenotypic as well as tissue data to do precision medicine. Moving into population health management, each of those elements acquired an insurance company and did each of those elements. We still felt a little bit further and further away from where the young people were, where the work was. And as I was kind of turning 60, Ophelia Dahl said she was going to step down as the head of Partners in Health. And a couple of board members were having breakfast with me, and we were trying to figure out what a kind of succession plan is. And one of them said, "Why don't you do this?" I really hadn't thought about it, but I thought, if I'm ever going to do this, it's going to be now, because I'm not going to do that kind of travel. I'm not going to start it when I'm 65 or 70. So if I'm going to do it for a few years or 5 years or whatever and work on this together. And then Paul and Ophelia prevailed upon me pretty intensely. So I took a 90% pay cut. When I asked my wife about doing this, she said, "Look, this is why we became doctors." She said, "You have to do this. It's just too much, so much closer to why we became doctors." And so I then had the privilege, of spending time in Haiti, Rwanda, Lesotho, Malawi, Sierra Leone, Liberia, the Navajo Nation. And one of the other sentinel events is Ebola started to become.
Yeah. So this is 2010 to 2015, right?
So yeah. So that in the end of in 2014, in the summer, Ebola started to break out in West Africa. And basically, there was no one doing work in the public sector in Sierra Leone and Liberia. And Jim Kim, actually, as the head of the World Bank, stepped in and put funds up to try to move people in fighting Ebola. There was a lot of effort. And PIH basically went to both Sierra Leonean and Liberian governments and said, "If you help us fight, if we let us help fight Ebola in the public sector with you, in exchange, we'd like to be able to help manage the poorest district in your country for at least 10 years afterward." It's the PIH model. Basically, can we find the hardest thing to do? And so, because PIH doesn't do emergency response, it's not MSF. This is not Médecins Sans Frontières. This is, so we basically, I was on the board committee that agreed for us to do that. The board voted to do that. But it was also more evidence to me that health system strengthening was necessary to prevent horrible outcomes. And those places where Ebola had been endemic for years, it was because the tipping point was that the systems were dust. Because of years of revolution in both of those countries, there were no structure. The ministries of health had no resources whatsoever. And so during my tenure, We moved into both, we created major footprints in Sierra Leone and Liberia. We opened the University of Global Health Equity in rural Rwanda, the Partners in Health runs, to start to create a centerpiece of training of exceptional young people in Africa who will stay there and not be brought, you know, to essentially be moved to Europe or the United States when they get their degrees, so they can become part of creating that ecosystem. It was an extraordinary privilege to be able to work with those exceptional people. So that's pretty much, you know, what I did. And I decided to retire from that after about 4.5 years, as I was turning 65, and travel got to me a little bit. You know, it was a lot of 24-hour flights on 4 planes and then a 10-hour drive on an unpaved road. And I think at that point, if I got a little chest pain, I might have got worried. While I was at Partners, I was, the only boards I was on were not-for-profits. You know, I was on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston and became its chair. I was on the board of Partners in Health. I was on the board of One Mind for Research, which I'm still on, which is a mental health charity or accelerator in terms of behavioral health science and advocacy and care, which is pretty remarkable. I didn't know for-profit work at that time. I thought it was just conflicted, and the Partners had enough negative attention on the political side in terms of its growth. I didn't need that attention on me. But when I was with PIH, folks said, sure, definitely join boards. We, you know, obviously gets us closer to donors and to other opportunities for PIH. And that's when Michael Greeley and Bill Geary asked me if I would work with them, as they had just raised the first fund for FLAIR, which was focused on health services and technology. And Michael had done some work with Partners, and I had also met with him on a trip to Israel that we had both taken when Deval Patrick went there. And so I started to work with them and to become engaged and learn about venture
investment. That's where we are today. Right. Wow, what an incredible story. Gary, I'm a little speechless, because I feel so privileged to be able to hear this journey that you've had. And I think it's a path that I found inspirational. I think anybody else would. There's so much I want to like go back into in terms of asking questions about it. I mean, I could talk to you for hours about your journey. Maybe taking stock of everything. Are there any lessons that you think you've learned through all those different, that you've learned all through all those different chapters that you would want to share with our listeners,
sure,
who might be earlier on in their career and residents who are in medical school right now?
First, I think don't expect to have a vision of every step of your career in the beginning. You know, for me, it's been mostly opportunistic. Opportunities that were presented by good and generous people, things that I wanted to do that other people weren't really interested in doing. Having a realization of my own limitations in terms of the things that I would either enjoy more or be like more likely to be successful of. So, you know, in an academic career, generally, everyone tells you to say no to everything and just focus on your lab so you can, you know, get your K award, get an R01, and, you know, then get a program project and, you know, become get tenure. And right. I said yes to pretty much everything. You know, Peter Weibrow asked me to revamp with a couple of wonderful people the behavioral science curriculum, which is always like a weak part of the medical school curriculum. And when I was still a fellow and then became involved with medical education through that and got to mentor exceptional young people who I still know and still work with now. And nobody is really interested in doing a space plan for the department that had no space, but sort of like, you know, administrative thing that I was, so I kind of fell in love with the people who were the department managers, administrators, and vice presidents in the hospital, and learned from them constantly. And so there's that one side. When I went to Partners as the head of Partners Psychiatry, I certainly didn't expect to become CEO. At that time, there were much more thoughtful and sagacious people than I who were, you know, ready to do that. And always focus on mission, 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 mission. You've got to have passion for what it is the organization's doing. And then understand that the people are what makes the organization spectacular. And the nurturance of young people is the power of the future.
Yeah. So always focus on mission. I'm writing these down. Don't be afraid to say yes. Find your passion, meet people, and don't plan things, or things are not going to be able to be planned. I like that.
And at the end of it, remember your personal, remember your personal life. Remember the people you love, who are the most important part of your existence, because that's the centerpiece of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Another question I want to ask. One of the things that I noticed hearing your journey is that you kept encountering the trouble, like challenges with access to psychiatric care, resources being allocated to psychiatric care. So, for example, I was just coincidentally in my psychiatry consults rotation 2 weeks ago. I'm sort of happy. It's a little fresh in memory. And what I kept thinking about was this adage, actually, that I heard in my neurology rotations in med school, where they say, you know, neurology sometimes can be frustrating because it's diagnose and adios, which is, you know, a little cheeky. But the point is, like, and back in the day, especially, you could diagnose people, but we didn't have therapies, and that's changed now. It weirdly felt that way in my psychiatry consults rotations because we would see exactly what our patients needed, and we knew that they could get better. And it was so frustrating. We knew exactly what would help them, but we could not get them that because it was just so difficult to get them to have access to care. And even the resources we have had at Stanford have been cut compared to previous years. Our inpatient service is also smaller than it used to be. And you kept encountering this and you pushed forward and you problem solved through it. And you've been really responsible, honestly, for helping us fight against some of those proclivities. I was wondering how you feel what you feel we should be doing next to try to fight these challenges around access to care, especially given the deep intertwined connection between psychiatric disease and the social determinants of health that get resourced a little bit differently.
So one, we have to think about them not being resourced a little bit differently. We've created an illness care system rather than healthcare system. And that's helped us to allow 800,000 people to die so far. A healthcare system protects older people who have frailty and illness and also pays adequately the people who are their caregivers in institutional settings so that they can have lives and be protected as well. A healthcare system understands the social determinants of life. A healthcare system focuses and creates equal access. And that's what universal health coverage means, not just payment. It's equal access to the highest degree of quality for the sickest and the neediest patients and doesn't kill people because they're Black or because they're poor or because they have less access to care. And our system has been focused largely on transactional payment with reward for places in which there are diseconomic payments. And that's distorted percentage of premium that's focused on areas that healthcare systems are still deeply incented to pursue. So if we're sitting with a drug arbitrage associated with infusion medicines, because they bring revenues in a certain way, we're going to build programs around that and try to increase market share and potentially even market size when it may not be necessary and create provider-induced demand. But the notion of primary and secondary prevention, or for chronic illnesses, tertiary prevention, becomes severely undervalued. And then if the political voice of the victims or their family members is either stigmatized or diminished, their ability to have access to that premium or to other social policy dollars that are necessary to amp them because they're not generally part of the overall healthcare system or can't be integrated overall because of the narrow fragmentation, it becomes tremendously difficult. But psychiatric patients who are psychiatrically ill or have chronic illnesses, you know, people ask me, why was I interested in psychiatry as opposed to internal medicine? Well, I'm more interested in schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, dementia, and depression than I am in congestive heart failure and hypertension and diabetes. I may, you know, basically be at risk for more of the latter, but I'm more interested in the former in terms of taking care of people with, and they're both really important. But the people who take care of all of those are all severely reimbursed, poorly reimbursed. So primary care doctors and general internists who are doing so-called cognitive work are, like psychiatrists and pediatricians, are severely under-reimbursed. And either areas in which we've created guild relationships in which there are severe shortages of providers, like dermatology, ophthalmology, and neurosurgery, are over-reimbursed, or procedures in which we can create arbitrages in terms of the payment mechanisms that are distorted over a period of time, are all consuming much more premium than necessarily increase length of life, allow us to do any kind of secondary or tertiary prevention or rehabilitation. And the skew needs to move premium in that direction, and also needs to drive coordination of cash flows that are outside of the healthcare system, rather than the direct insured healthcare system, to be able to have a hold overall. I mean, that's, you know, some of the beautiful models like PACE for older adults, where we're at least incorporating and then creating complete flexibility of full Medicare premium for duals who are at super high risk, I mean, and who have already been qualified for institutionalization in terms of their care, creates much better outcomes if, in fact, if those dollars are used thoughtfully and coherently. And the same, from the same token, people with severe mental illness who may be also at risk for social consequences like homelessness are sitting with life expectancy in the young 50s. What is that about in this environment? They're also, their access to general care is quite poor, and the ability for the current model of primary care to take care of them in those offices is so under-equipped. The risk should be sitting somewhere else. The risk has to be sitting with people who are providing the principal home for their needs overall, and then can also access what's secondarily necessary for them. But part of the challenge is that the entire system at the present time is premised on a continuation of those arbitrage-like payments, and to nudge them to have, you know, more favorable outcomes, either is all around getting the low-hanging fruit around improved, you know, navigation or fragmentation, or creating inexpensive substitutes that are either technology-based or less skilled for that patient population. And that's not necessarily going to avail them to 21st century
discovery. That is so beautifully said. And I can definitely hear your geriatrician hat on and your psychiatrist hat on. I feel like that's so awesome that you, like, those are the fields that really, really get this. One of the things I'm curious about is something I chatted with Don Berwick on, actually, is, you know, how do you overcome the challenge of arbitrage? Like, payments are so much easier. Like, they're like quick, instant money. And, you know, maybe, I don't know if you found yourself in this position as CEO of these health systems or hospitals, be like, well, you know, we should do that because then we can use that quick money to finance these other needs. And then I don't know if it moves off the balance sheet over time or something. Because we were talking, Don and I, about these Medicare Advantage startups and what he calls the Medicare money machine, which is this, you know, a little bit provocative notion that a lot of these Medicare Advantage startups have earned their revenue, maybe not as much like ACOs, and he compared them on reducing cost of care and providing higher quality care. Maybe they do that too, but really they're getting fast money on upcoding with HCC codes and using technology to do that. And maybe you have to sort of do that to also make sure you finance primary care, which is so important. But, you know, have you encountered any challenges in being able to, the push towards getting the quick arbitrage money versus the hard, long work of doing the quality work?
There's no question. But it's not just a push toward it. It's that our systems are directed towards it, right? So academic health systems in general have part of their mission that is magnificent is driven by specialty medicine. We'll never get the kinds of science if we didn't have a focus on specialty medicine. We'd never get specialty trained and to take the minds of extraordinary people to solve very, very narrow problems overall. And what comes with that specialty medicine is also procedural medicine to cross-subsidize and fund it, or the drive towards using basically very, very expensive infusible drugs that have a crazy payment mechanism that's associated with them. So they become mutually beneficial because you deeply want to be able to do this stuff. And at the same time, it's deeply profitable to build more accessibility around that. And that then, the financial drivers of the strategy skew the direction away from the more the broader population health management. And it's harder to do, unless you have massive populations, it's harder to do population health management when you have a very expensive capital infrastructure. Yeah. So if you have bricks and mortar and you have debt service, which is what those academic institutions have, you become, to some extent, anchored in stuff that doesn't allow you to make new and novel decisions that are essentially have different payment mechanisms away from it. And that's the vision of the Affordable Care Act, was to give us a long term to be able to do that, to evolve with value-based payments that were less punitive over a period of time to more and more in the way of risk, and to drive us. And the interruptions we've had in the implementation of that genius, I think, have made it more difficult, because that was the only singular health policy we've had in the United States ever. Right. I mean, you know, it's the only one that also reported at the highest level, you know, government in a way that's anyway similar to places that have, you know, universal health coverage. So I think that, that's a challenge. On the other hand, I think we've all appreciate that changes in payment mechanism are necessary to be able to deal with healthcare costs crowding out other policy expenditures, either on the government side, and the government is deeply responsible for a massive amount of payment. It's not just Medicare, Medicaid, and all the agencies, but it's also, you know, the tax coverage that exists for healthcare premiums. So private healthcare premiums, you know, are not taxed as income right. overall. So that's a government cost as well. So the government is some way paying, you know, a substantial burden in every aspect of healthcare at the present time, even catastrophic care for people who don't have any insurance. So in order for us to be able to solve that without having permanent deficits or crowding out our ability to invest in education or roads or the green economy or in other social benefit that enriches people, or in leveling the playing field around racism and the reparations that are necessary to be able to have a true plan to you know, be able to leverage that kind of change from a social perspective that's necessary for the future of our society, we're going to need to make reductions. And the notion of whatever it is that we're calling as value-based payment is the one thing that people are starting to appreciate together that will start to move us away. The question is, what will be the consequences and or the rubble that sits behind that if those decisions are not made thoughtfully and slowly with some kind of a glide path?
Yeah. Well, what do you think the consequences might be for health systems since you were, you know, in that chair? What do you think people should be concerned about or adapt to?
I think they have to be careful. I mean, health systems have, you know, while, you know, I saw that Medically Home just did a raise for $120 million. They said they have 500 patients monthly. And that's taken them a while, but it's 500 patients. And the investments are from Kaiser and Mayo originally, and they're working with those clinics. That said, if one transfers 30 or 40% of the revenue that's on the inpatient or technology ambulatory side of the Mayo Clinic and moves it into people's homes and substitutes for the fee-for-service that's driven that evaluation, it will change the structure of the Mayo Clinic. It'll change the ability to manage and be able to support a substantial pieces of specialty medicine that have distinguished that. And the question is, what will be the substitutes? What will come of that care? Where will be greater efficiencies in those specialty areas? And that becomes challenging overall. And the workforce to deliver the front end of care, that care in the home, primary care based, even if it's supported by technology, doesn't exist yet, right? And so the lead time to get that workforce is also necessary overall. So one is going to have to make financial decisions, and the bond issues that Mayo Clinic has or its physical infrastructure are dependent upon some of the older assumptions it's made. Hopefully, you know, it has a strategy. I think that's very progressive to try to change that. But nonetheless, what it has made its living on is people flying to Rochester, Minnesota, or to Jacksonville, or to Phoenix to basically be evaluated outside of where they get most of their healthcare delivered to provide a third opinion around that or to provide a specialty intervention. And that's associated with, you know, essentially diseconomic payments.
Beautifully said. That is incredibly insightful. Being mindful of time, I want to ask my last question that I ask everybody. And is there something you came across recently, Gary? It could be another podcast, a book, a TV show, a song, The COO of Lyra recommended a tricycle. Anything you've encountered recently that you found cool or interesting you'd want to share with our guests?
So many things. I would say required reading for all of us is a set of books that understand the issues of social justice in our society and the effects on individuals of a lack of that justice. So I think folks should look at the work of the Equal Justice Initiative and Brian Stevenson's book, Just Mercy, to understand how great work is necessary to undo the evils of our justice system and the explicit racism that sits not within its fringes, but within its mainstream. And I think it's worth, you know, spending time there and in becoming truly literate in all the work around anti-racism that's necessary, which sits as a great cancer and evil in the society.
So important. So Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson. Thank you so much, Gary. It's been such a privilege and treat to have you on. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support us, please leave a review on Apple Podcast or whichever podcast platform you use. And if there's something you found you really liked or didn't like or would like to make a suggestion, feel free to reach out by email at info@tdio.org.